Welcome to Toati Mechanach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Leah Meyerfeld, and today we are learning Melachim Aleph, Chapter 9. Does unconditional love require unconditional giving? Absolutely not, says my husband. Love and expressing love are so clear to him, thank God. Our teenage daughter raises an eyebrow. It's nuanced, she says, and we all discuss what giving is needed in a loving relationship. Children, she says, theoretically, need to know that their parents are constantly loving and giving in some way. Placing limitations that they don't understand might cause a child to feel unloved, so when boundaries are placed, the love needs to be expressed in another way. I understand this. Gevurah must always be tempered with chesed. Constant giving is an expression of constant love, she maintains. I counter that sometimes not giving is an expression of love. She finally admits that even in unconditional loving relationships, not all physical things need to be given unconditionally. So we agree our relationship is based on unconditional love, but she's only borrowing the car to go visit friends after the Pesach dishes are put away. Shout out to Yael for thinking deep and always challenging us, and for all your help while you were home from seminary. King Shlomo has finally finished building after years and years. His Lifetime Achievement Award is a second revelation from Hashem. Just as Hashem had spoken to him as he was starting the building, so too now. The unconditional presence is promised. You ask me to be present, says Hashem, and I promise you this place will always be mukdash, holy and consecrated. My eyes will always look to here, my heart will be focused here, always and forever. Then Hashem makes the parameters of what will be given clear with a double conditional. If, then, and again, if, then. The relationships between Hashem and Shlomo and between Hashem and the people are defined. Personally, to Shlomo, Hashem repeats his own words. You maintain you are the continuation of your father David. If you go in my ways as he did, wholeheartedly and honestly, if you keep all my commandments as he did, then your dynasty will reign eternal. And between God and the people, here the condition comes in the negative. If the people do not follow my ways and instead go after other gods, then I will send them out of this land. God's love for Israel, the people, was expressed with clarity at Mount Sinai. The promises we heard were unconditional. You be my people, I will be your God. The promise of connection to Israel, the people, is an eternal promise. Not so the promise of living in Israel, the land. The place that King David fought for, that King Shlomo glorified, is forever mukdash, holy, but the people can only reside in it conditionally if they keep the Torah. The gift of residing peacefully in our own land, it seems, is very much conditional, dependent on our showing faithfulness to the way we have been shown. If we build a Torah true society, then we will retain the land. God's choice of us is irrevocable. God's showering us with the chesed of the land of Israel must be earned anew by each generation, by each individual. What that means is that the story of Am Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael is always being written. Its conclusion is far from preordained. If people will look at Israel and see the temple destroyed, they will know, the whole world will know, that we have fallen, that we have followed Assyrian, Babylonian, Roman traps of values. We have put our faith in weapons, force, and power, faith in beauty and externalities, faith in science and nature, faith in falsehoods. If we raise our vision to a higher standard of righteousness and compassion, that can infuse the world with the spirit of Hashem and bring everyone to uplifted behavior, then Ki Mitzion Tetze Torah Udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. We must earn the land with Torah. Then we will merit to see the words of Hashem in Yerushalayim. I want to also look quickly at the words of Hashem's promise to Shlomo and a beautiful midrash based on it. In Hashem's words, he describes his attitude to the new temple. And my eyes and my heart will be there all the days. Hashem's presence will always be in the temple. The Talmud brings a dispute about tefillah that comes from this verse. Two sages disagree on where the eyes of a person should be directed during prayer. One says, the worshipper should put his eyes down, as it is said, and let my eyes and my heart be there on the earth all the days. On the other hand, the other says, his eyes should be looking up, as it is said, let us lift up our hearts with our hands raised to God in heaven. As they speak, a third wise man comes and answers them. The worshipper should put his eyes down and his heart up, so that these two readings will both be fulfilled. What does this mean? This disagreement covers two extremes. Should our focus be like God's, from heaven downwards, or as a person towards God, from the earth towards the heavens? The decision of the third sage connects them and holds that it's possible to balance between the heart and the eyes, between this world and the spiritual world. One idea is that eyes looking down means excitement for a person's actions here, what we each accomplish. Heart looking up means to recognize it all comes from Hashem above and be humble in all those actions. Another explanation is that our eyes should be focused here means on this world, things we can see that we ask for, health, livelihood, but our hearts should be focused upwards towards Hashem, growing spiritually. Shlomo's prayer ended only one chapter ago, and here we receive a directive on the nature of prayer, not from Shlomo's perspective, but rather from Hashem's way of engagement with the world. The combination of the two verses shows us the complexity of prayer. It's not one-dimensional, but rather a combination, a balance between our spiritual aspirations looking above this world and the understanding that you are a physical being here on earth. The prayers have been responded to, the building is finished, and now we will see in the next few chapters how it all plays out. But introductions are super important. Verse 1. Everything that Shlomo desires to build is finished. Yirmiyahu uses the word cheshek, desire. This gives us insight into how things are decided and prioritized by Shlomo. We also see that the building of the house of Hashem and the house of the king are mentioned as two buildings together. The royal house and the godly house are interconnected, and King Shlomo is the one developing both. There is no separation of religion and politics, no church and state, as we say. We will see how corruption of the monarchy plays out in corruption in the temple. During the second temple days, there is no kingship of the house of David, so there is separation of religion and politics, but the price, on the other hand, was manifested in the corruption of the priesthood itself. In the days of the Second Temple, we see discord between sects and serious religious divisions. There's a debate how the days of the Third Temple will look. All we know is that it will be built according to the prophecies that will come at that time. Yirmiyahu now shows how it's all coming to fruition. Shlomo's policies, foreign relations, after 20 years of building, we are first told how the relationship with Hiram, king of Tsur, plays out. There are significant business dealings. Hiram has sent materials, and King Shlomo doesn't have fluid funds to pay him. He gives him 20 cities in the north, and Hiram isn't even happy. Giving land is huge and problematic, practically and philosophically, as we know. We wonder, how could Shlomo cut into the land and give it to Hiram? Many of the commentators try to explain how Shlomo could do this. One idea is that Hiram gave Shlomo other northern lands for the Jewish people in exchange. Another explanation is that the land wasn't actually given, but rather just the crops from that area. Be that as it may, despite any religious issues with giving away the land of Israel, Shlomo makes this move as a political, financial one. A strategic decision because he needs the relationship with Hiram in order to gain ocean access. We learned about this previously, and here it develops. More and more contracts being signed, ships go out with Shlomo's and Hiram's sailors on board. Hiram's men are again training Shlomo's, this time in the shipping trade. They travel far for international commerce. The power of the seas to turn a nation into a superpower is amazing. King David had foot soldiers control land as far as possible, but a naval force makes sure nations even beyond this hear of Shlomo. He has access to resources in distant lands. And this brings us to the story of the daughter of Pharaoh. This story is part of Shlomo's life from the beginning till the end. His marriage to her is one of the first things we learn about him when he takes over the throne. We don't hear details then, but now we are shown that something special happened here. He takes wives from many countries as part of trade and political deals, but Pharaoh's daughter is unique. It's unusual in the ancient world because it's the only time that we know that a foreign nation took a daughter of the Pharaoh. Pharaoh is not just one king, not just many kings with the same title. Pharaoh is a concept. It is the superpower, an empire, a force. We know that no slave ever escaped Egypt. This means that not just individuals, but whole nations were swallowed up into the Pharaoh empire. All dealing with the Pharaoh lead to women being taken to the Pharaohs, not vice versa. This was a unique honor for Shlomo. Shlomo has an alliance that is different than the usual. We are told in verse 16, Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, came up. It seems not to embrace Shlomo, but to fight against him. After King David and Yoav, his army commander, who were powerful warriors, the young and soft new king must have seemed to Pharaoh as an opportunity. But Shlomo's army stopped the onslaught. When Pharaoh got overwhelmed, he sees he is losing. He sacrificed the city of Gezer to escape from the encirclement of Shlomo's army. The Canaanites still lived in the city under Egyptian rule, despite King David's battles, and now he, Pharaoh, captured Gezer, burnt it with fire, killed the Canaanites who lived there. And he was also forced to give his daughter to King Shlomo. But King Shlomo doesn't take this for granted. He uses his marriage to the Pharaoh's daughter to show everyone the alliance he now has with Pharaoh. We look at Pharaoh's daughter and she has status. At first she lives in Il David, but when the king's palace is built, he brings her there. He has filled the valley in the Silwan area and built her a compound. It changes the topography of the city, the makeup of the city, the walls and ramparts. In other areas, cities are also built in her honor. A special palace for her solidifies her status and also shows Shlomo's respect for Pharaoh. The alliance is strong and powerful. Imagine how much this all cost. We are told Shlomo also levies taxes. And how many workers? The nations left in Israel are enslaved, but we are told, perhaps ironically, the Jewish nation isn't enslaved. They come as workers, warriors, and soldiers. But these quote-unquote non-slaves have an entire hierarchy above them. Perhaps not everyone was so thrilled to be part of this endeavor. We'll see the repercussions. The chapter ends by telling us that all this is done to build up the country as an international player, a political and financial force, and it comes hand in hand with King Shlomo bringing sacrifices to Hashem. We recognize the religious aspect of his reign as well. Thank you for studying together, Lilui Neshamot Imoteno Yekarot, Esther Oppenheimer Aleha Shalom, and Sarah Schenker Aleha Shalom, each deeply devoted and proud to transmit their family's Torah legacy to the next generations.